Headlines: three Palestinian men are killed and over a dozen others injured in Israeli nighttime aerial and ground raids on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Iran strongly condemns France for hosting a meeting of the MEK terrorist group, warning Paris against the political and legal consequences of its move. Also coming up, Ukraine says Russian troops are advancing in four areas in the east of the country amid fierce fighting along the front lines. Welcome to World News from Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story. Israel has carried out aerial and ground raids on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, killing three Palestinians and seriously wounding several others. Eyewitnesses say Israeli warplanes fired several missiles toward a house in the center of the Jenin refugee camp. One victim has been identified as Sameh Abu'l-Wafa. Following the aerial strike, Israeli forces stormed the city. Israel has recently stepped up its deadly attacks across the occupied territories, especially in the cities of Jenin and Nablus. Palestinian resistance groups have warned against the atrocities. The Islamic Jihad movement says Jenin will not surrender and that the regime bears responsibility for the consequences of its aggression. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine says the Israeli assault will only increase the Palestinians' determination, and Hamas says the Zionist regime will not achieve its goal through aggression. Tehran has categorically condemned France for hosting the anti-Iran MEK terrorist group and warned Paris against the political and legal fallout of continuing to support the outfit. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman slammed France for hosting an MEK gathering at a time when protests fueled by political and social discontent have gripped the country. Nasser Kanani said the move shows that Paris turns a blind eye to its own citizens' demands and continues to give political support to terror groups. He underlined that the terrorists who have committed heinous crimes in Iran will definitely not hesitate to betray their foreign backers. Kanani also urged the French officials to address the root causes of the problems, including their racist and biased treatment of citizens. Meanwhile, Iran hailed a recent operation by Albanian police against the MEK terrorist group. It's been 16 years since the launch of Press TV Channel. The platform says it wants to be a voice for the voiceless and has tried to be an alternative for the vast and wealthy mainstream media corporations. Despite multiple attempts to shut the channel down, whether online or on air, Press TV is still standing tall 16 years on.
Hello everyone, it's 8:30 a.m. here in Tehran. You're watching the news here on Press TV. A warm welcome from me, Hassan Tabakoli.
And from me, Saeed Purit.
Press TV News Network was launched in July 2007. It is Iran's first 24-hour English news and documentary network. To try to provide a different narrative against what is produced by the mainstream media is not an easy job. That's what Press TV has been trying to do all along. The coverage of issues like the Israeli regime's daily atrocities in the occupied Palestine, U.S. war crimes in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, and the very fact of hypocrisy on the part of the so-called mainstream media has brought Press TV on the wrong side of many people. It also offers a unique perspective into social issues in Western countries like the US and a fresh viewpoint into news about Iran. By offering a platform for Iranian voices and perspectives, Press TV contributes to a more comprehensive understanding of Iran and its role in global affairs. Press TV has faced hardships and bans since the very first day of its launch. Perhaps the most notable of such bans was in June 2021, when the channel's web domain was seized by the United States. In fact, by shutting down Press TV, the US decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the US narrative. It has also been taken off air by Eutelsat, SES Astra, and Galaxy 19 satellites over sanctions imposed by the EU and the US. Its Facebook page with over 4 million followers was arbitrarily removed. Its entire YouTube channel was deleted and banned from using Google services. And in 2012, it was taken off the air in the UK by Ofcom, Britain's telecom regulator. To challenge the narratives of the Western mainstream means Press TV has to swim against the stream. This has not been easy for the past 16 years, but as long as its audiences are growing, Press TV says it will carry on giving voice to the voiceless.
Now to the front line of the Russia-Ukraine war. The Deputy Defense Minister of Ukraine has reported fierce fighting, saying Russian troops are advancing in four areas in the country's east. Ghana Marius also said the Ukrainian troops are making progress with partial success on the southern flank of the flashpoint city of Bakhmut, which had fallen to Russian hands in late May. Malia said that Ukrainian troops are moving forward in the south despite stiff resistance. Kiev launched its counteroffensive last month to retake lost territories, but it has failed to make headway so far. The latest developments on the ground come as Russia carried out an overnight drone attack on Kiev for the first time in 12 days. Russia's envoy to Geneva-based UN offices say there are no grounds to maintain the status quo of the Great Black Sea grain deal that is set to expire on July 18th. Gennady Getelov told Russian media that the implementation of Russia's conditions for the extensions of the agreement was, quote, stalling. He said Russia has repeatedly extended the deal in the hope of positive changes, but added the country does not see any improvement in the situation to agree to preserve the status quo. Sweden has condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran in Stockholm after days of angry protests across the Muslim world. The Swedish Foreign Ministry described the move as Islamophobic and offensive to Muslims. It said the blasphemy was committed by individuals at a demonstration and in no way reflects the views of the Swedish government. Sweden had given the permission for the desecration to go ahead, citing freedom of expression. People in some Muslim countries urged their governments to sever diplomatic ties with Stockholm as Swedish envoys were summoned. There have also been calls to boycott Swedish products, including by Egypt's University of Al-Azhar. Pakistan's Istiqam Party started a hashtag to boycott Swedish brands, which soon became a top trend on Twitter. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has also called for collective measures to prevent future acts of desecration.
Anger is boiling across Islamic countries following the desecration of the holy book Quran in Sweden. In the latest move, Iraqi protesters in Baghdad gathered near the Swedish embassy carrying placards reading Quran is our constitution. Several other Iraqi cities witnessed similar protests. The sacrilegious act also triggered condemnations and outrage elsewhere in the Muslim world. In Bahrain, protesters chanted slogans in support of Islam and the holy book Quran. They also urged Muslims to unite. Iranian protesters also gathered outside the Swedish embassy in the capital, Tehran, to condemn the blasphemous act. Protesters carried signs reading "Down with the enemies of the Quran." They demanded the closure of the Swedish embassy. The move also drew reactions from Iranian government officials. President Ebrahim Raisi said the Muslim world will never overlook the recent act of sacrilege against the holy book Quran in a Western country. He made the remarks while addressing a Friday prayer event. Raisi said Quran was disrespected in a Western country that claims to defend the freedom of expression. Iran's foreign ministry summoned Swedish chargé d'affaires in Tehran over the recent incident. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian expressed strong criticism of the Swedish government for allowing and supporting the desecration of the holy book. He said the Muslim world categorically condemns insult to holy scriptures and Quran. Allowing sacrilege and insult to Quran under any justification by Sweden is unacceptable. The top diplomat added misusing democracy and freedom for such behavior would only incite terrorism and extremism. Other Muslim nations also reacted. Pakistan condemned what it called the despicable act of publicly burning Quran in Sweden. Morocco recalled its ambassador to Sweden for an indefinite period. Turkey, Jordan, Qatar, Egypt, Syria, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, and other Islamic nations warned such acts inflame feelings of Muslims worldwide. The sacrilege has also raised calls to boycott Swedish products. Al-Azhar University in Egypt has called for the boycott. The General Secretariat of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is also set to hold a meeting next week to discuss measures against the desecration.
Now, the desecration of the Holy Quran brings to the spotlight the question of escalating Islamophobia in Europe. The West justifies the sacrilegious act under the pretext of freedom of speech. Others, however, have called the move a provocation that will only create hatred among nations of the world.
The reaction to Quran desecration in Sweden comes as the incident is not the first such instance in the Scandinavian nation. Earlier this year, a politician burned a copy of the Holy Book outside the Turkish embassy, drawing outrage from the Muslim world. Although such sacrilegious acts are not unprecedented in the West, what makes the recent Quran desecration in Sweden stand out is that it happened after Swedish police granted permission for the planned move despite previous international outcry against such measures. The man tore out pages from the Holy Book and set them on fire despite objections from onlookers. But taking a brief look at social media activities of Salwan Mamika, the Iraqi man behind Sweden desecration of the Holy Book, there are points that need to be addressed. First and foremost is that Mamika identified himself on social media as a secular liberal atheist. That is why he has a weird type of cross tattoo on his right hand. The other factor is that Mamika received a Swedish passport on February 20th, 2022. Before this date, he didn't share any anti-Islamic posts on social media platforms. Based on those activities, it is clear that Mamika is either a troubled, unstable, and narcissistic man looking for attention and fame, or is backed by one or multiple political intelligence powers to create sedition and instability not only in Sweden but also in Iraq. What seems to be an interesting point here, though, is the backing NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg threw behind Mamika's act, saying that the action is part of freedom of expression. If that's the case, why protesters often taking to the streets across Europe to demand the implementation of their basic rights, especially in France, are often faced with violent police crackdown?
We should not tolerate these things. We just have to say stop. It's not okay to humiliate other people. So,
freedom of speech is very important, but I think burning a religious book, it's not freedom of speech. It's another thing, it's a provocation.
Taking a brief look at the recent history of Europe, it clearly indicates that such blasphemous acts not only have violated the rights of the people of the world, but they have also added fuel to the fire of extremism and terrorism, as Iran foreign minister put it.
Political commentator Faraz Ali joined us earlier to explain why Swedish officials seek calm in Muslim countries following the Quran desecration protests.
Yeah, the difference is that before, from 2020 until now, the Swedish government said, we don't want to discuss it. You have to adjust to this. This is Sweden. We have freedom of speech. Accept it. But now, as Sweden wants to be in good foot with Turkey because they want to join NATO, they have gone out and condemned this issue. Even the prime minister this time, the Swedish prime minister, invited Muslim leaders to his residence and talked to them. And even the opposition leader in the Swedish parties, they asked the Swedish Muslims to use their contacts in Muslim countries to calm down the situation. Because Sweden is in a special situation now because of the war in Ukraine.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Tropical forest loss generated 2.7 gigatons of carbon pollution in 2022. That's one figure from a new report finding tropical deforestation increased in 2022 despite global pledges. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams reported, despite world leaders' pledge to halt and reverse global deforestation by 2030, the tropics lost 10% more primary forest in 2022 than in 2021. That's the latest update from the World Resources Institute's WRI, Global Forest Watch, released recently, which found that tropical forests had lost 4.1 million hectares, generating as much carbon dioxide as India emits from fossil fuels in a year at 2.7 gigatons. One thing is clear, what happens in the forest doesn't stay in the forest. Francis Seymour, a distinguished senior fellow in WRI's forest program, said, as Mongabe reported. Seymour added that the data gathered by the University of Maryland was particularly disheartening because of its timing. At the COP26 UN Climate Conference in Glasgow in 2021, 145 nations signed the Glasgow Leaders' Declaration on Forest and Land Use. That included a promise to work collectively to halt and reverse forest loss and land degradation by 2030 while delivering sustainable development and promoting an inclusive rural transformation. Seymour said, "We had hoped by now to see signals in the data that we were turning the corner on forest loss. We don't see that signal yet, and in fact, we are heading in the wrong direction. The analysis focuses on tropical forests because more than 96% of human-caused deforestation takes place there, and because primary tropical rainforests are especially important for protecting biodiversity and regulating both the global climate and local temperature and weather patterns. Temperatures near newly deforested areas can increase by twice the amount forced upward by the climate crisis alone." The update found that the world lost an area of these essential forests the size of Switzerland at a rate of 11 soccer fields per minute. That's over 1 million hectares more than it should have to meet the global goal of halting deforestation by 2030. The WRI's Rod Taylor said, as British Broadcasting reported. Taylor said, "Globally, we are far off track and trending in the wrong direction. This could have serious consequences for both forest communities and efforts to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Already the world would be around 5/10 degrees Celsius warmer without forest. Since the turn of the century, we have seen a hemorrhaging of some of the world's most important forest ecosystems, despite years of efforts to turn that trend around," Global Forest Watch Director Mikhaila Vey said at a press conference briefing reported by AFP, adding, "We are rapidly losing one of our most effective tools for combating climate change, protecting biodiversity, and supporting the health and livelihoods of millions of people." The website of VION, meanwhile, reported, new research has highlighted damning figures as it revealed that an area equivalent to the size of Switzerland was cleared from Earth's rainforest in 2022. The report comes after a number of pledges globally to take definitive steps to end deforestation by 2030. The report by the World Resources Institute's WRI Global Forest Watch said that a massive chunk of the tropical forest disappeared as forest destruction rose by 10% compared to the previous year. The report also stated that the rate of loss was equivalent to losing 11 soccer fields of forest per minute as swathes of tropical forests were cleared for farming, mining, and other commercial activities. The report mentioned that tropical primary forest loss in 2022 totaled 4.1 million hectares. It further added that all this forest loss produced 2.7 gigatons of carbon dioxide emissions, which is equivalent to India's annual fossil fuel emissions. The report mentioned that non-fire-related losses reached the highest level since 2005. Such instances in the Brazilian Amazon are most often due to clear-cut deforestation. During the last year of Brazil President Jair Bolsonaro's administration, a high rate of primary forest loss occurred, which was an important agenda for President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva during the election. After winning the election, he even laid out a plan to end illegal deforestation in the Amazon, which was a major campaign pledge that is a critical step in addressing the country's significant carbon emissions from the region. Just a few days after the election result, Lula and his environment minister, Marina Silva, unveiled the action plan for the prevention and control of deforestation in the Amazon.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us begin the day by contemplating on what the Prophet's 10th infallible successor, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon him, has taught us of the merits of performing the ziyarat or visitation to the shrine of immortal martyr of Karbala. There are definite places in which God likes the servants to supplicate to him. One of these places is the tomb of Hussein, master of the martyrs, peace be upon him.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, shunning conceit. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of shunning conceit in the Islamic lifestyle. Well, in the Islamic lifestyle, when we look at the Islamic studies, we see that conceit is a disfavorable act, and no one likes this act in the Islamic, according to the Islamic studies. Therefore, it is necessary that we go towards the shunning the conceit. Now, what do we mean with the conceit in the Islamic lifestyle is to have an exaggerated opinion of oneself. If someone is having an exaggerated opinion of oneself, or he's pleased with oneself, or maybe you can say it is a vanity or egoism, all of these are because of some superiority in one's thought or success in one's action. And that's why he or she thinks that he is superior to others. And this is also known as arrogancy. Therefore, in Islamic teachings, it is said to not to have such a characteristic because it is not a desirable characteristic. The reason is this kind of thinking and this kind of characteristics take us towards the ashtray. It does not allow us to go towards the perfection. You know, when someone in the Islamic society thinks he is better than others, he is superior to others, and then he does not perform any more good deeds, then obviously there is the time that he is going towards the ashtray and he is going downwards. Therefore, it is necessary to stop ourselves from being arrogant and from being loving ourselves only. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of shunning conceit in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the conceit, we know that a conceited man has come up short in knowing about the Lord and his greatness and in realizing his own need and dependence on the God. The reason is when he thinks that he is superior to others due to his actions or due to any reason, he feels that it is because of himself and relies on himself only, and he forgets about the God. He forgets about the bounties of the God. And for this reason, he is proud of his material and spiritual capabilities and boasts about his successfulness in thoughts and action. Now, he is unaware of the fact that all kinds of perfection and capacity that he has, maybe it's in the material like word or the spiritual or the favors that are from God, and all sorts of good deeds and success in his life, they all have come from God. He forgets all these things. He becomes unaware of this perfection. He becomes unaware of the blessings that are given by God. And that's why it is necessary that we avoid conceit in our life. We avoid the exaggeration of opinion about ourselves. And the reason is that we need to be humble. We need to be humble so that we can get the success. This humbleness will take us towards the peak of the perfection. The more we are humble, the more we are down to earth, the more we are, you know, humble in front of people, the more we get the perfection. There is more chances of knowing the reality about ourselves, and there is more chances to be grateful to God, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Congo. Part 2.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. On June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Six Muslim organizations in Canada have filed a lawsuit in a court in the province of Quebec calling for a recent provincial order that prohibits all forms of prayer in public schools to be declared unconstitutional. The groups are seeking a judicial review of the ban, arguing that the order is discriminatory against Muslims and violates the right to freedom of religion and of association. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote in this regard, Quebec's war on Islam and Muslims continues. Its latest assault is the ban announced by the Quebec Education Minister, Bernard Drainville, on Muslim prayer rooms in public schools. Adding insult to injury, the ban was announced on April 5th, in the middle of the month of Ramadan. Drainville cited the province's policy on institutional secularism. He should have been a little more honest and admitted that it was because of the province's policy of institutional racism, especially against Muslims. After all, Quebec's Bill 21 forbids government employees and teachers from displaying any religious symbols while at work. This prohibition specifically targets Muslim women and girls wearing hijab. Islamic organizations and mosques in Quebec were outraged by the prayer room ban and launched a court challenge. Unfortunately, even judges have been infected by the Islamophobia virus. Justice Lucas Granosic of the Quebec Superior Court on June 14th denied a request to suspend the province's ban on prayer rooms in public schools. The case against the ban was lodged by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and the National Council of Canadian Muslims. They had argued that the ban was causing irreparable harm to Muslim students and needed to be suspended immediately. Muslim students couldn't wait while the wider legal challenge made its way through the courts, they said. While the judge acknowledged that the ban violates religious freedom and could cause irreparable harm to Muslim students, he didn't see the urgency of the matter. He advanced the strange argument that groups hadn't demonstrated the need for urgency because they only filed their requests for a stay in June when the ban went into effect on May 3rd. Judge Gronisk told the court on June 14th, as reported by the Canadian press, the delay is not explained in the proceedings and remains inexplicable. The judge admitted that there are serious questions about the constitutionality of the ban, but added that those would be settled during a full trial. He said the constitutional violations were not sufficiently clear for him to suspend the rule so early in the legal challenge. Judge also said it is not clear that the student would be immediately harmed by the rule because classes had ended and the students were only required to be at school to write exams. When Quebec Education Minister first announced the ban on April 5th, Muslim organizations in Quebec expressed outrage. In a joint press release the following day on April 6th, representatives of several mosques expressed their indignation at the minister's decision. The mosques are members of the Table de Concertation des Organismes Musulmans. They wrote, "We are also indignant that this decision is made in the middle of Ramadan, a month of blessings, fasting, meetings with all fellow citizens, and prayers for Muslim citizens of Quebec. The authors represent the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec, the Islamic Association of Rimouski, the Islamic Cultural Association of Eastern Townships, the Association of Muslims of Greater Lévis, Mac Quebec, the Sociocultural Islamic Association, Louvervois, and Belle Aguirre Quebec. It needs recalling that the Islamic Cultural Center of Quebec was subjected to a terrorist attack on January 29, 2017. Six worshippers were shot and killed by Alexander Bissonnette while they were offering their nightly prayer. Another 19 were injured, one paralyzed from the waist down, Bissonnette was sentenced to life prison on 6 counts of murder, but the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that he would be eligible for parole for 25 years. Also, Middle East Eye reported recently Islamophobia is deeply entrenched in Canadian society and black hijab-wearing women are the most vulnerable, a Canadian Senate committee report says. Far-right and anti-Muslim hate groups are growing in Canada, along with incidents of hate, according to a report by the Senate Committee on Human Rights. The report is set to be released in its entirety in July. Police reported hate crimes against Muslim communities across Canada increased by 71% in 2021 alone, with around 8 incidents per 100 Muslims, a Statistics Canada reported last year. Canada has a problem, committee chair Senator Salma Atalojin said recently in a phone interview with the Canadian press, where she discussed the unreleased report, adding, "We are hearing of intergenerational trauma because young kids are witnessing this. Muslims are speaking out because there are so many attacks happening and they are so violent." The committee also found that attacks against Muslims often take place in public, for example, on the streets, and appear to be more violent than attacks targeting other religious groups. They also found that far-right and anti-Muslim hate groups are some of the driving factors behind these attacks against Muslims. Earlier this month, Muslims in Canada called for more protection and a serious engagement with Islamophobia after a man entered a mosque, brandishing a weapon, threatened congregants, damaged mosque property, and tried to run over worshippers in the parking lot. A 28-year-old was arrested and is facing several criminal offenses. In 2020, a mosque caretaker was killed in the Toronto area, while 3 years earlier, a gunman killed 6 Muslim men at a mosque in Quebec City. But the Senate committee began its work in June 2021 after 4 members of a Muslim family were killed when a pickup truck ran over them as they were taking an evening walk in London, Ontario. Currently, a man is facing terror-related charges for the killings.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. In today's program, we will be discussing American ambitions damaging Pakistan and Bollywood being used to spread Islamophobia. So stay tuned.
In this episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Pakistan's relations with the United States of America, and we shall take a look at Islamophobia in Bollywood.
Is Pakistan trying to maintain a golden mean in its relations with China and America? There's an agreement in Pakistan on the importance of strategic relations with Beijing. But at the same time, many doubts have been raised on the nature of Islamabad's relations with Washington.
The decades-old relation between Pakistan and the United States has not been enduring. Instead, the ties have witnessed periods of antipathy and estrangement. In a recent interview with a US-based media outlet, the Foreign Minister of Pakistan, Hina Rabbani Kar, said that Islamabad wants to have good relations with both Beijing and Washington and cannot choose between the two. However, periods of close ties between the two countries have been governed by America's requirement for Pakistan's cooperation to serve its strategic interests. On the other hand, Islamabad also needed economic and diplomatic help. Nevertheless, this symbiotic relation left both sides discontented. The relationship has done more bad than good to Pakistan, as a South Asian Muslim country does not share any long-term goals with America. It has also played a significant role in hindering Islamabad's relations with other countries. U.S. ties with Pakistan have obstructed democracy in the country, strengthening the army, in turn damaging the liberal and autonomous institution of Islamabad. It's important to note that the periods of close relations between the two countries were governed by military dictators in Pakistan. Support of military dictatorship by the White House and its imperialistic policies in the world has made the people of Pakistan wary and dissatisfied with the US.
During the Soviet-Afghan War and after the September 11 attacks, Pakistan did not have the flexibility to decide what role it wants to play in the United States' strategic ambitions. Islamabad was forced to act on the dictates of Washington, as Pakistan's compliance determined the economic support it would receive from America.
According to strategic relations experts, the reason for successive US governments to have praised Pakistan was to manipulate the South Asian country to fulfill strategic interests. America's long-term strategic and economic ambitions never aligned with Islamabad, therefore the needs were met through transactional relations. The mere fulfillment of the US designs that brought the two countries together has been followed by reprimanding Pakistan. In the 65-year period of ties between the two countries, Islamabad has been put under sanctions for 25 years, though the sanctions are not as severe as on Iran. Commenting on the alliance between the two countries, some foreign experts have been saying that Pakistan holds no permanent value for the United States and its relation with Islamabad depends on Washington's ambitions in the South Asian region. The weaponization of the economic power by the US has destroyed weak countries like Pakistan. Islamabad is still battling with the deluge of America's war on terror in Afghanistan that led to the emergence of Takfiri groups that have affected the economy and security of the country considerably. Meanwhile, the failure of America's 20-year Afghan war speaks volumes about its problematic military and foreign policies.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Assistant Professor of International Relations, Federal Urdu University, Dr. Faisal Javed from Karachi. Welcome to the program, sir. It is believed that more than half a century of relations between the US and Pakistan has done more harm than good to the South Asian Muslim country. What is your opinion on this, sir?
Thank you. It's a good question. And I teach my students in my class and discuss with my colleagues and friends. In international relations, Lord Palmerston said that there are no permanent friends and there are no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. So Pakistan and U.S. relations have faced several challenges in their relationship. Both countries are celebrating